Thank you, Bill. 5 minutes after 12 o'clock. It's a Thursday, a day that God is good all the time. Of course, that works any old day, but we're just happy to celebrate God anytime. And got a couple of guys in the studio that would probably agree with that. God is good. It's Matt McAuliffe and Chris White here to do our monthly program on church history. And as you've heard us talk, well, maybe you wouldn't consider this guy. You know, we've talked about some pretty august people, you know, St. Augustine.
You don't get any more august than that, eh?
Yeah, that's just what I... And so, and Martin Luther and Leo, well, we've done, you know...
We've done some crazy people, even Abraham Lincoln.
Absolutely. He's not as crazy as others, but...
That's true. And, of course, this being February, we need to... You know, we don't want to neglect. We had Lincoln last year, and we don't want to neglect the other president who was born in the month of February.
Well, what's another Christian president we could look at?
How about...
Jose Garfield.
How about Benjamin Harrison?
We're going to look at George Washington today.
Hot diggity. I like George Washington.
Of cherry tree and silver dollar fame. You know, and Pat, I got to confess, every once in a while we get a tough one where Chris and I do our research, you know, yeah. We get Jessica working on the internet to find material. And
well, we had a fight about this one.
Yeah, well, you know, it was hard.
We almost broke up.
My jaw still hurts, you know? Well, you know, you get the evidence, and there are people that look like Christians, and then there are people that really are Christians. And that's one of the things that's most difficult, and we're going to talk about that today, is if you have a person that's not very demonstrative about their faith, you can really have trouble sifting through and finding the evidence that shows you that they are disciples of Christ. Abe Lincoln was a tough one for us. Florence Nightingale.
Yeah.
There are a couple there, you really get more of a feeling than you do an absolute rock-solid conclusion. But we think we got a Christian here, and we're gonna show folks the evidence that we've got. Now, one of the big problems is the founding fathers, who are often credited as being Christians, were more influenced by a Christian worldview, and in fact, were what we call deists, as opposed to real live born again Christians. Mm-hmm. How would you describe deism?
A deist would be a person who believes in God, but doesn't believe that God has actually spoken in a form of special revelation such as the scriptures.
The watchmaker thing.
Yes, exactly. The watchmaker thing where he wound up, he was the creator, and pretty much though he is not directly so much involved in the affairs of man. Whereas that differs, of course, from the view that we and most Orthodox Christians would hold, and that is that God did create, God is the creator of all things, but also that God has spoken, that God has made his will and his message clear to us, or as clear as humans could receive it, in the Holy Scriptures. And so deism is friendly towards God. In no way is it unfriendly or atheistic in any way, but it would set aside the idea that God has spoken to man in a rational way.
So he's not a personal God.
Not so much a personal God. Interestingly, though, the records show that, and it's kind of an in vogue thing to lump all the founding fathers in there as deism. Deism was a popular thing at the time because the time era we're talking about was in the Enlightenment era. However, the vast majority of the founding fathers were actually members of what we would call bona fide Orthodox churches at the time.
Mm-hmm.
And so it was probably not as widespread in that fraternity of men who were laying down the foundation stones of this country.
Well, you know, with that understanding, Pat, you can see that right away we're going to have trouble sorting through some of this stuff.
Okay.
Now, some of the big obstacles in our way, one, we need to identify a trend that has been taking place over the last 50 years specifically in our history. You know, if you read a U.S. high school U.S. history book today, you'll be pretty stunned at what you find. It's not the history, you know, if you're more than 30 years old, it's not the history you learned. Basically, I'll bet you'd be surprised to learn that Harriet Tubman wrote the Constitution and...
No kidding!
Okay, that's a little out there, and I love Harriet Tubman, but it's just... There's an agenda-driven thing called deconstruction, in which any Christian influence among our leaders in history is really, they're looking to launder that right out of existence. What they want, they don't want Christians. They want to just make the Christian heritage of our country disappear. You know, whatever.
Pretend like it never happened.
Yeah, it never happened. These guys were good, solid guys. They did a good job for us, and we should honor them, and blah,
and
blah,
we,
blah.
But we want to selectively ignore the evidence.
Absolutely. And this is this gets into evaluating Christ, the historical Christ, you know, the garbage that the Jesus Seminar has come up with. Mm-hmm. You know, it's a whole movement. And so we need to be aware that that's out there, because a lot of what they'll do is toss out all the sources that we have. They're not willing to do their homework and kind of painstakingly comb and cull through the evidence. Now, on the other hand, we're talking about a guy here who, I mean, is really too good to be true. Even his enemies were in awe of George Washington. This guy, I mean, he's perfect. He's his, you know, almost perfect. His virtue, his graciousness, his
his general good taste.
Oh my heavens!
Honestly, the guy knew how to run a White House even before there was a White House.
He really
had a sense of who he was and the type of person that would hold the office and the dignity of the presidency. I mean, he was an extremely good person. But one of the things that does happen, as you and I have even brought up on this program before, is sometimes when we read about a historical figure, some of the only things we have in writing about them are written by people that may have gone just a skosh overboard.
You see,
and there's actually a category of literature that we call hagiography,
right,
which is, of course, the literature of the saints. And there's also another form of literature that goes all the way back to the Greek times and the Roman Empire called panegyric, which is something that is written after somebody is dead, but it is mainly to extol their virtues. And so when we have this literature, we don't want to discount everything that is said as being unfactual, but we have to sometimes approach it with caution.
It's like now, like the stuff on St. Francis,
exactly,
the stuff on Constantine that Eusebius wrote. You can't take it at face
value.
Even
good old St. Patty.
Even St. Patty, yes.
Bless his soul.
But you know, in our circumstance, when we talk about someone like George Washington, we've got to remember that he was an incredibly good man and an important man, but also that there was a body of literature out there that did definitely build the image. And one of the most notable ones is the one written by Parson Weems, which is the Notable Anecdotes of Washington's Life. And it's where we get the story of the silver dollar being thrown across the Potomac, the chopping down of the cherry tree, and a lot of things that probably were not totally fictitious, but certainly were embellished a bit.
Yeah, he didn't make this stuff up. He just didn't critically examine the evidence. Yeah.
You know, I grew up in D.C. and loved to go to Mount Vernon, and there's no way you could throw a silver dollar across the Potomac.
Is it like a mile and a quarter or something?
I identified that even when I was six.
But it would cost you a dollar to drive across the Potomac River on the toll bridge getting into Washington. So.
But is, you have to be careful with Pastor Weems' biography, but you don't want to throw the baby out with the bathwater. I mean, a lot of these things had, you know, their germination in truth. I mean,
yes,
he culled most of these stories from people that knew Washington. He just wasn't very selective about what he used. It just all went.
Can I interject an interesting thing?
No, absolutely.
Okay. An interesting thing that just came out in the process of going through some of the literature about Washington was the fact that in Europe, some of the things that would be written about a king or leader of Europe, to be at the level that Washington is treated in the literature of the time, took about 200 years, so that, you know, there'd be enough time to forget about all their bad points and only remember their good points, where the same amount of literature about Washington actually took only about 20 years, because he was such a phenomenally virtuous person and also so widely loved and revered by American society. Well, as a matter of fact, if you think about it, you being in Washington or a former Washingtonian, you have seen the Capitol Dome, in which we have Washington riding in glory painted on the ceiling of the Capitol Dome there. You have in the Smithsonian that statue of him dressed in a toga,
oh, yeah,
sitting on the throne of Augustus Caesar. I mean, that was the type of viewpoint people had of Washington, and it was probably not for nothing that they had that view of him.
I know, it really makes it difficult. I don't know, on top of this, we don't have a lot of George's personal papers. What we have are a lot of public speeches.
Martha put him out on eBay right after he died, I'm almost certain.
Well, and in addition to that, the last thing to examine before we really get into the evidence is the fact that Religion at that time was just coming out of civil wars and the Reformation. Yeah. And to be honest, a real demonstrative emotional religion was looked upon badly if you were an educated person. It was kind of scary. That's how people got, you know, killed and persecuted and burned. And so it was called enthusiasm. So if you got really too excited about your faith in sharing it, you were an enthusiast. And, you know, you really didn't advance very far. So it was the fashion. And I'm not saying that to negate Washington's spirituality, but just to let folks know that this does not carry a lot of outside. I mean, he's not on street corners passing out tracts and evangelizing.
And certainly that actual value is alive and well in our mm-hmm. country today. As a matter of fact, the
private
vast
religion.
Amount of Americans believe that religion is something that is more of a private affair,
mm-hmm.
and that there are some things that, well, we just consider it even rude in conversation. So it's very much a value that's alive and well.
So as we examine the evidence here, let's be thinking of that. Now, the first thing we want to do, everybody knows the youth stories. We're not going to worry too much about that. I mean, he grew up fairly wealthy and well-off and educated. But by the time he's a young man in his early 20s, he gets opportunities for advancement. And truthfully, one of the characteristics of George is he was ambitious.
Definitely.
I don't mean in a social climber kind of way. He wouldn't tread on anybody's toes getting there, but he was not afraid to put himself in the way of an opportunity. He would speak to the governor and say, "Oh yeah, I'll do that for you. Oh yeah, I'll take that position." He had a lot of confidence in his ability to execute the duties of these offices. And well, history has proven that point right. Well, one of the things he did, you got the French and Indian War. Okay, 10-second instruction on the French and Indian War. Just in from the East Coast over the Allegheny Mountains, the Ohio River starts. It effectively cuts the country in two. And this is why both the French and the British are desperately wanting control of it. Okay, well, that's really the French and Indian War in the 1750s. And Washington makes three or four trips out there, first as a messenger, then as a young lieutenant
colonel.
He's
commissioned as a lieutenant colonel.
Yeah, and this is the Fort Necessity thing. Uh-huh. You know, he gets out there with not enough men, not enough
bullets
equipment.
Bullets whizzing by.
Oh,
how
my
he
gosh.
Survived that had to be divine intervention.
Well, let's talk about that. When they finally got serious, the British got serious about sending an expedition out. They sent him out under General Braddock, crossed the Allegheny Mountains, and were ambushed by the French, who were the original mountain men. They were tough and good fighters, allied with the Six Nations of, you know, Indians out there. Well, the poor British, they were just wiped out. I mean, they're still wearing red, marching around in, you know, took him a while to learn that lesson. But here's George Washington writing up and down, "Every other officer has been shot dead. There are 500 men laying dead around him." He's rallying his troops. They're all behind the berm. He's riding up and down, and he's got two horses shot out from under him. He's got bullets whizzing through his hat, through his sleeve, through his coat. But he goes through this for an hour without getting a scratch. Well, okay, he finally gets his men and brings them back and right. Leads the retreat and is kind of a hero as a result. That's one of the reasons they go to him to be commander-in-chief later. But years later, he meets, in the company of a couple witnesses, so this is documented, he meets an old Indian who has come to visit him, who says, "You know what? I was in charge of that ambush, and all of my braves were aiming at you. I had the other officers down. We were all shooting at you. We shot at you for a long time. And finally, we decided the Great Spirit did not want you to die, and we stopped shooting. We were afraid we would make him angry." Now, you can take that for what you will, but I mean, given that everybody else was dead, and George just calmly rides up and down, I mean, it's the kind of thing that happened. Moving into the Revolution, this sort of thing followed him all over the place. The miraculous escapes, the fog that descended on the river as he's taking his troops out of Brooklyn Heights.
Yeah.
You know, that as a matter of fact, the British officers who were chasing the Continental Army got mad. They got frustrated. General Clinton, serving under Cornwallis, is chasing one of the armies. And he finally writes back in a dispatch. He's just sputtering with rage. He says, "I had them cornered. I had the army cornered. And they came upon the River Dan, which was in flood stage. And then the river dropped, and the Continental Army just crossed, they just went across. And then as soon as they had gotten across and I started my people across, the river rose again." He's just, this is in a military report, it was miraculous.
And then, of course, there was the miracle of that guy that just happened to be with the easel and the oil paints when he was crossing the Delaware.
In the very next boat. And the oil paints didn't freeze up
that
or anything.
That blew my mind to even think about that.
Well, we won't even get into all the miracles that that kept that army alive. But one of the biggest things we want to touch on is you've all seen the Valley Forge prayer painting. Okay, it's huge. And that is one of the stories that was contained in Pastor Weems' biography. And that's one of the things that the deconstructionists want to throw out. Well, as we got digging more and more, we're discovering there's quite a bit of documentation to this story.
That one actually really did happen.
With people that were against Lincoln, or against Lincoln. I'm sure there were people that were against Lincoln if they would have known he was going to be born, but people that were against Washington.
Real quickly, here's the story. He's camped out in Valley Forge. I mean, you know, the guys are, everywhere they walk, they leave a blood trail in the snow. Nobody's eaten. They're naked. I mean, it's like Stalingrad, you know, in the 1700s. It's horrible. And Washington is just set upon. And they're in Valley Forge. It's owned by a Quaker family, the Watts. And Isaac is one of the guys that runs things out there. And he does not like the war. The Quakers were very anti-war. They were Tories. They were not happy that the army was there.
Pacifists.
Absolutely. And, but, you know, what are you going to do? 10,000 guys show up with guns on your doorstep. You know, sure. Enjoy. Camp out. Whatever you want.
Have some oatmeal.
So Isaac is walking through the woods one day. And he hears, as he's going through the woods, he hears this muttering. And he creeps up in the bushes. You had to be careful. It might be Indians. Who knows what it might be. So he creeps up through the bushes, and he looks, and there's Washington on his knees in the snow, praying and weeping. It's just a really one of the few demonstrative manifestations of spirituality we've got for George.
But he did it in private.
He did it in private. He figured there was nobody there. Well, Isaac comes back, and his wife can see he's weirded out. You know, he's upset and in a good way. And he tells his wife, "You know, I've this day seen what I never expected. Thee knows that I always thought no man could be a soldier and a Christian at the same time. But George Washington has this day stake, and if he is not a man of God, I am greatly deceived." Well, this story is attested by three or four witnesses. As a matter of fact, two generals, Peter Muhlenberg, the German general he brought to teach his men maneuvering, and the French general Lafayette, mm-hmm. came upon Washington in the same way in a stable and just opened it and heard what he was doing and backed out of there. I mean, General Henry Knox, after whom Fort Knox, Kentucky is named, the artillery general who served with him there, said, "Oh, gosh, he did that all the time. He went out to the woods to pray all the time. He never let any of us go with him." So what you've got, basically, is a lot of documentation to prove that painting true. George Washington is a guy that when the chips were down, he went out in the woods and he lifted his cry up unto God.
Now, he also had a prayer journal, Matt.
I'm glad you reminded
me. Yeah, that was a phenomenal find. And this is something that's documented. This isn't something that's out of a right-wing Christian publisher. This is just certainly something that is in the collected papers and historic documents of George Washington.
Well, let me read a short one. This is just his journaling prayer Monday evening. "Most gracious Lord God, from whom proceedeth every good and perfect gift, I offer to thy divine majesty my unfeigned praise and thanksgiving for all thy mercies towards me. I have sinned and done very wickedly. Be merciful to me, O God, and pardon me for the sake of Jesus Christ. You gave us your Son to die for me and have given me assurance of salvation upon my repentance and sincerely endeavoring to conform my life to his holy precepts and example. Bless, O Lord, all of mankind, and let the world be filled with the knowledge of you and your Son. I beseech you to defend me this night from evil and do more for me than I can think or ask. For Jesus Christ's sake, in whose most holy name I pray." You know, this is a guy that does not have a problem. You know,
and he used the J word right there.
He used the J
word. Well, you know, that takes us through some of the, you know, the well-known things about the soldiering days. But, you know, there's even evidence when he was president of this as well. One of the things we know for a fact is that he was not an informal believer of any kind. He was an official member of the Anglican Church, and then later when it became the United States, became the Episcopal Church. He was formally baptized, like all Christians. And then, of course, now Matthew and I have disputed this, but Matthew has produced the evidence that he thinks that he took communion.
Well, actually, it was communion.
Communion, whatever. You call it communion, I call it communion, whatever. But you know, also, when he took the oath of office, and remember, we've got to be cognizant of the fact that he was the one that kind of almost invented this ceremony. He was the one that had the idea of putting his hand on the Bible and taking the oath of office. He was the one that added the phrase, "So help me God," to the end of it. And he, in his ceremony, reached down and kissed the Bible as part of this whole thing. His policies certainly were ones in which he didn't write a lot specifically using biblical quotations, although he did in some of his writings, but definitely they carried the values and the theology of someone who is a Christian. And one of the things that we noted was just his own morality in the way that, for one thing, as president, reaching out to Jewish people and assuring them that they were not second-class citizens in the United States, but were among all other citizens. And then his relationship to the slavery issue. And the slavery issue at the time, and was up until the Civil War, one of the great immoral things in our history. And Washington sought to legislate it out of existence, if it were possible. And, of course, it was not one of those things that was a politically possible or probable thing at the time. Mm-hmm. But he, in his own personal life, and not everybody knows this, but when he died in his last will and testament, gave the freedom to his slaves. And that was certainly something that was unheard of at the time.
Didn't he come up with the first Thanksgiving?
He was also the one that actually did the first Thanksgiving. It used to be the third of October. When the first one was proclaimed, and later came to pick up the November date after Lincoln. But that was he who invented a day of thanksgiving unto God for the blessing of the land. So there's things leading in that direction, pieces of evidence that we would have that shows here is a man who definitely was certainly spiritual for sure, but we believe moving as a Christian.
You don't have that statement of the governor's anywhere, do you?
You know, I do have that, actually, now that you mention that. And this is an actual quotation to a message to the 13 governors of the American United States. He says, "Do justice, love mercy, demean ourselves with that charity, humility, and pacific temper of mind, which were the characteristics of the divine author of our blessed religion, and without a humble imitation of whose example in these things hope to be a happy nation." So there's a fairly faith-specific quotation right there, even in his policy papers as President of the United States.
Sounds a little bit like Micah 6:8 to me.
Well, it sort of has that feel.
Love kindness and walk humbly with
your
God.
So what are we coming to with the conclusion about this? Well, first of all, we know that we have plenty of evidence that Washington believed in a personal God. He did not believe in a God who was not intimately involved in the affairs of men, and specifically in his own life. He was definitely a believer in providence and believed in a big plan, that God had a plan, actually, for this country, and was one of the marks of his leadership and genius. Was behind that, he saw a big picture, and part of that big picture was he saw the God of the universe actually working through history and unfolding a plan for this specific country.
So what we're left with is a guy that does not look like a deist, basically, Pat. Mm-hmm. Christopher and I, you know, it's so hard to say for sure on anybody, but we're going to come down and say, you know what, it's pretty likely we're going to be seeing old George in heaven. And we'd like to leave with a quote. This is from Chief Justice John Marshall, who was a gnarly Christian and served as a staff officer in Valley Forge with Washington. What he said, to put this to rest, is, "Without making ostentatious professions of religion, Washington was a sincere believer in the Christian faith and a truly devout man." And I don't believe he would have said that if he didn't believe it. So from John Marshall and from a whole world of other witnesses, we deliver to you George Washington, believer.
John Marshall, the first Chief Justice of the United States, and of all those great men back in the colonial period, George Washington, I mean, we're talking Benjamin Franklin, Alexander Hamilton, Thomas Jefferson, they all considered George Washington to be, hands down, the cream of that crop. So there you go.
And he looks so good on $1 bills, Pat.
Yeah, he does. He's a handsome fella. very tall. In fact, I think the tallest president was Abe Lincoln, and the second tallest was
George Washington.
George Washington. You know who the third tallest was?
Bill Clinton.
Yep. You're right.
But he didn't have wooden teeth.
No, no. Anyway, thanks, fellas. Thanks for the look at George Washington, one of my just favorite all time. I've read several biographies of George Washington. Of course, living in Washington, D.C., you got to get a pretty high view of this guy. And, hey, he deserves the reputation he's got. He really was a great gentleman, godly man, I believe, also. So thanks for doing that. Matt McAuliffe and Chris White here today. We're going to do it next month in March. I forget who's coming up, but love these.
So do we. Do you remember what we're doing?
Remember.
I don't remember either.
Well, that's okay, fellas. I'll look it up. We'll get into it. But we got How to Manage Your Money coming up in just a moment. Okay, stay with us right here on KDOV.
On the next Renewing Your